Hello and welcome back to Syria's Lost Generation, a podcast about young people displaced by war. This show is a production of Foreign Policy in partnership with the humanitarian groups World Vision and the Syrian American Medical Society. I'm your host, Liam Cunningham. In the first five episodes of the podcast, we visited Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan to learn about the plight of some of the more than 12 million people who've been displaced by a decade of conflict. In this episode, we'll be speaking to Hassam El-Haraki, a friend of mine from Syria who fled the war 5 years ago at age 16 and now lives near Stuttgart in Germany. But before that, we're once more joined by David Enders, a Beirut-based journalist who has covered the war in Syria and has been our guide to the conflict so far. David, welcome back.
Hi, Liam.
As we conclude our series, do you have any thoughts about Syria's future or what comes next for those who have been displaced?
Well, in the last few days, I've reached out to some of my Syrian colleagues and friends from my time working in the country and covering the war. One thing they all have in common is that they no longer live in Syria. Some are wanted by both the government and rebel groups that were intolerant of any dissent. All of them have simply gone in search of better, safer, more stable lives. They're all still involved in making films, researching, writing about the conflict, or managing humanitarian efforts in Syria. And they may have left, but what is happening in Syria is very much still front and center in their minds. Another thing they have in common is that they don't see this ending anytime soon. This is Nidal, a friend of mine who grew up in Damascus and is now living in the U.S. He was forced to leave the country in 2012.
Oh, it might go on for more than 10 years even, like maybe for other 40 years, David. I don't see it like really close to an end. The end of this, if what's going on in Syria has only one solution, that al-Assad should go away and then start a new chapter in Syria, whether like to continue a civil war that would end in a way or another at the end. But like an Assad in power, and this is going on, this is not going to end anytime soon at all. I mean, he destroyed the whole country. He humiliated people. He imprisoned. He killed. He is a murderer, and he should go to the court. He should be imprisoned and held accountable. But as long as he's in power, this is gonna go like on and on, and maybe on and off and off and on, until he's gone. Until something changed.
That's disheartening.
It is. And I think really one of the hardest things for Syrians is coming to terms with the fact that their revolution was hijacked by outside powers. As long as Russia, Turkey, Iran, and other countries continue to play a large role there, there's not much hope for a better Syria. This is Humam, a filmmaker I met after he was injured in Homs in 2012 in the same rocket strike that killed British journalist Marie Colvin. He lives outside Syria now, but when I caught up with him, he was working in the north on a film about life in one of the camps there.
I see two wars in Syria. The first war is between the international powers. In this war, I think Syrians has nothing to do with it because we have no choice in that war. And we have another war with, for us as Syrians, it's some kind of challenge to rebuild our country.
I just want to play one more clip of Humam, because even with all the despair, he does have some hope.
When I go to the camps and see all these children, the life they live is really not easy life. But still, you find many of these children trying to have a dream of Syria. I mean, although most of them, they have known nothing in their lives but war, but still somehow they have a dream that we want to have a future in our country. So I see hope in the future, and I think if you want to have a bright future, you need to work for that. So I try to build this future with other Syrians, and that's what gives me hope.
But Liam, let's get back to Hassam. How did you meet him?
I first met Hassam, this incredibly impressive young man. And he was, I think, just into his 16 and a half years old. He had left one of the camps without permission, him and his mother, and had managed to get a small flat in Idlib, this town. I think it's about an hour and a half away from the capital of Amman. And we met him on the street because he was fearful that the Jordanian police would see our little van arriving and it would bring eyes upon him. And if he was found, him and his mum would be put back into the camp. And my handlers at World Vision, who had introduced me to him, said, "You're going to like this guy. He's a fantastic guy." And it's one of those things when people talk about another human being, you kind of say, "Oh, he must be impressive," because they smiled when they mentioned his name. And true enough, when I met him, was this extraordinary bundle of energy, this incredibly positive, self-confident young man. We went around to his apartment, met his mom, and we were talking, and he had a mobile phone in front of him with a full-size keyboard. And every day, and he was religious about this, every day in the afternoon he would sit down and do at least 2 hours, perhaps a lot more. And he was learning German off YouTube, which is, of course, incredibly impressive, especially from a young man, a teenager who you would imagine be out playing with his friends and just being a young man. And he had this level of discipline. What I didn't know at the time, he had already done this with English. So when he was in the camp, he was teaching himself off his mobile phone to improve his English. And now he was moving on to a second language. And he spoke incredibly positively about how to improve his situation. He gave himself a number of projects. His main project when I met him was to expedite his getting out of Jordan and reuniting with his family in Germany. His brother, they had been separated when they arrived to Jordan, and his brother was the first one to get out of the country and get to Stuttgart. So that gave them a kind of an end game to arrive. At least somebody would be there, a friendly face, a family member. And the trouble was that his passport was going to be up in January, and I had met him, I think, in August. So he hadn't got a lot of time that he would have travel papers to get to Germany with his mother. But he wasn't defeatist about things at all. It was another level of difficulty that has had in his life that needed to be overcome. And it's very difficult to turn away from somebody who has that faith in themselves and has that sunny disposition and who hasn't been beaten down by circumstance. Just my admiration was, and continues to be, huge towards this young man.
And the conversation we're about to hear is recent. Had you spoken to him in a while? Because it seems like, had anything changed in his life?
You could say that, David. Every time Hossam messages me, I close one eye and I press the button and I have a look at what particular thing he's accomplished. And every time it's just something that you kind of go, where the hell did that come from? And one of them was that he did tell me, "I'm thinking of becoming an actor," which I immediately panicked because it's a ridiculous career choice. I just love the rollout of his life. The going from disaster, from almost certain disaster, from having his life turned upside down, nearly getting killed, nearly losing his family. You know, I think he's got the acting bug out of his way, thank God. But he's getting on with his life. He's got the prospect of things that we take for granted. And, you know, Hossam is not he's not unique. There's ladies and gents all over the displaced who are getting on with their lives, and they deserve so much better. They deserve the chances that Hossam has had for normality. Okay, enough from me. Let's hear the conversation. I started asking Hossam what life was like for him in Syria before he got displaced.
So before the war begins, my father was a wealthy man, I would say. So he was getting into business, and I would say we had money. So I'm proud of it, because other people in Syria,
they don't have money, and it's stressful, and it's hard, difficult. But our family, somehow, we had money, so we lived well.
Yeah. A lot of people in the West, just lacking information, would have thought that people in the Middle East, refugees from a war, were goat herders, were subsistence farmers. And it's taken me a while, as it has with you, Hassan, to convince people that there was university students, there was middle-class people, upper-class people. I heard somebody use the term in Syria that people were at the opera on Saturday night and their houses were bombed on Sunday. There was all stratas of society, all levels of society were affected by this thing, as there is for every war.
Exactly. So I was 11 and we were getting news about the war is escalating. The war just got more and more. What I actually really remember is after the Friday pray, we go to pray in the mosque. So when we go back to our home, as we were walking home, a car on the side of the village got bombed. A car. So because nearby our village was a military base. And this car just got bombed. Nobody knows why. So after checking out and seeing what's the problem, it was just a truck, which is transporting gas bottles to inside the village, which was not allowed. So nobody knew about it. And inside the truck was a whole family. And the truck got just bombed. Man, you can't imagine. The people just rushed into this truck and they wanted to help. But you know what happened? The military base just started to shoot at this truck. And the people were scared, so they couldn't do anything. And the people, like the bosses of our village, they wanted to speak to the military base. They went there, they spoke to the military base. They said, we just want to take the bodies from the truck. So just let us. They said, okay, you can go. They went there, like four people. They got shelled with a temperature missile.
Heat-seeking missile, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And they just died there. And this is something I saw with my own eyes. And like this moment, I just knew a war is just starting in Syria.
And that was the first violence you saw in your village, or the first time you came face to face. How long was it before what happened in your school? What was the time difference?
So after this happened, the village were taken from the military base. So we had to flee from our village to another village. And our village is named Al-Mulayh Al-Gharbiya, okay? It's in south of Daraa. So we went to Saida. It's in another village. So we stayed there. We had a house and the people were just welcoming there. And they said, okay, hey, people, just have a house and live your life, okay? It's no problem. We fled inside Syria. We were refugees inside Syria, okay? We lived 3-4 months there and I got to go to school. And so the school just got bombed.
I mean, you were in class at the time, weren't you? Tell us what happened.
Well, at this day, we were writing our English final exams. It was just the final day of school. And planes began striking, bombing the school. Man, you can't imagine this moment. For me, it was like, I am dead. So I was 14 and I told myself, man, you are dead. While I was watching the schoolyard, I saw somebody lying on the ground and it seemed to me like someone I knew. So I rushed up with some of other classmates to him and I couldn't believe it, man. I just couldn't believe it. It was a very good friend of mine and my cousin.
It's a terrible thing when your parents have turned around and they're saying to you, we need to have some normality for our children. We need to have some routine. So we need to send the children to school. And then the place of safety that you send your children to gets bombed. And the teachers get injured or killed and your friends get killed in a place of safety.
Exactly. So the moment I walked home, my parents thanked God that I was still alive. And it was really the last straw for my father.
Okay. Okay.
So this is the moment my father decided. My father was saying, it's not safe. We have to get somewhere else. My father said, guys, we have to do this. Trust me. So a cousin of ours gave us details of a smuggler. Me and my dad and mom and the three brothers had the same opinion as my father. But my married sisters stayed with their husbands. The first step was driving out into the desert of Leja. It's just a desert of rocks. Anyway, trucks drove us as far as they could. And from there on, we had to walk. We stayed a night in this in a small building, waiting for another group. Well, for sure, I couldn't sleep there where because there were 75 people in the small room. 30 more people arrived in the morning, and the smugglers didn't tell us how far they would be going. So we didn't bring a lot of water, and many of us left any extra clothes or food behind too. Because no one wanted to be the slowest, actually.
And Hassan, is this the point you had your backpacks on? You had like the hiking backpacks? I remember you telling me.
Exactly. So I was told by the smuggler, hey, he looked at me and he laughed. He said, oh dear. I was like, you just told me it's 1 kilometer. He said, I don't know about that. But if I were you, I would have just thrown this away and took like the dattos or something. So I was like, all right. So I told my father. My father said, it's hot. It's really hot. So you throw them away. They said like 2 kilometers and we're there. So my father was sure we're arriving in 2 kilometers. Anyway, the smugglers were saying, as I told you, 1 kilometer and we will arrive. But they were lying, absolutely lying. It's a good technique. It's a good technique. If you want to get somebody to do your goal, you have to lie to him. Anyway, if they said 30 kilometer or 40 kilometer to go, we would have given up. Like, we would have said, man, this is Leja, we know Leja. So that morning, we walked 30 kilometers. 30. We were running out of the food and water. Everybody had water, just drank it. But absolutely in secret, so nobody else sees that, because if anybody sees that, it would get like really risky for him, because everyone will just attack him and want the water.
You're 105 people walking in the desert.
Yeah, exactly. So pregnant women, old people, and a guy who was like really old, he ran out of water and they just forgot him. Behind, and you know what? Yeah, they forgot him behind, and his sons, they looked after him, and they didn't find him anymore. So they told the smuggler, and one smuggler went back, and he said, "Guys, if you want to go back, it's I'm not going with you because I found him dead."
So his children were with the father. The father had a diabetic attack, no insulin.
Exactly, and no water. So the children of the like they were like really like 18, 17, and I think a daughter, which was like, I think, 14. So they just started crying. My mother said, because I was like in the front of the group, I was the youngest. So I had this backpack, I throw it away. So I was like really the quickest. And at some point I was walking and this woman walked to me and say, please, please, Hussein, please. Take my child, so just carry my child. I see you are just fit and you can walk. I can't walk anymore. So I was like, it's a child, it's a responsibility. I can't carry this child.
So when these mothers are saying to you, please take my child and make sure my child gets the safety, they're saying this because they think they are going to die in the desert and they want
absolutely
their children to live.
Absolutely. So this woman just come to me and give me her child. This very little child.
And you're 14 at this stage, yeah?
I was 14. So I took the child and I watched the mother the whole time. If she walks, I walk. If she doesn't walk, I stay. Because you can't imagine, this is not your baby, it's not your child. So, and she had like a backpack. So I told the women, please throw your backpack away because it's not realistic.
Yeah.
So you can't walk yourself. She said, this is the food of the child, the baby.
Yeah.
This is the milk and the bunch of other things. Yeah. I did it. I did it like for 7 kilometers and I couldn't anymore. So I went to the woman and told her, can I give your baby to someone else? To someone else. So I went to my brother, my older brother, Ahmed, and I gave him the baby. Ahmed, my brother, was like really shocked. It's not our baby, man. So I was like, it's the baby of this woman. Let's just follow her the whole time. And we just changed. So I walked back and I walked for and the whole time.
So tell me, Hassan, tell me what happened when I remember you saying something about when nightfall came, when the nighttime came.
Exactly. So almost at the sunset, we were entering a very dangerous area. It's very guarded, good guarded area from Assad's troops. So we went to this area, like 7 kilometers. We walked in this area. And as I mentioned, the smuggler told us, hey, we have to be very quiet and we are not allowed to do anything. So if the child cry, like just, I don't know, put him down, do something with him.
Yeah.
And he told us also that similar groups got killed in this area. So we have to really take care of ourselves. Oh man, this area was really well guarded. So we were seen and we got spotted. And the shelling started. And in the dark, man, in the dark, you can't see anything. So my brother, he found a bottle and unfortunately, he thought it would be water, and he drinks finally, and everything's all right. But he drank from the bottle, and it was poisoned. And he got poisoned. And he told us the whole time. We carried him. My two other brothers carried him because I had to watch out for my parents.
Yeah.
My mother and my father, and my two other brothers, they just had to carry him against his will because he said the whole time, leave me here, hey, please. Because if you, I'm a burden. So you carry me and the shelling started and just leave me here. One man dies, but not the whole family. So we were like, no. And somehow I heard the smuggler just talking to somebody on the phone, and he was telling him, hey, please have a million and come. He was pleading to him, and it seemed like the truck driver wouldn't want to, he doesn't want
to
come.
The truck driver didn't want to come to pick all you guys up.
He was scared too. He said, all the shelling and all the bombing, I'm not coming. You give me 2 million, I'm not coming.
This truck was going to take you to the Jordanian border, is that correct?
Exactly.
Yeah.
After the rocky way, after 70 kilometers walking. So my father jumped out of the nowhere. So I was like, oh, father, what are you doing? So he was talking to the smuggler and he told him like that, hey, you know where this truck driver lives? Let's go to him and like try to
persuade.
Yeah, exactly. Him and tell him, hey, come. If he doesn't want to come, if it's absolutely no way, we just kill him and
take the truck.
Like one man dies and 105 survive. So the smuggler was, all right, good idea somehow.
So from your life of going to school, you are now having to think about, and your family is having to think about murdering people to stay alive, and people in your group are having to think about leaving their parents in the desert, are having to keep quiet so you won't be spotted by military and shelled. And I mean, these are, for a 14-year-old boy and all the other young kids and parents that are there, the stress, it's appalling that families would have to go through this, and you don't even know if you're going to die from lack of water, lack of food, shelling. I mean, it's a terrible journey, isn't it, Hassan?
Well, I think people, normal human beings, they just forget bad things. When bad things happen, these human beings, they just try to forget about the bad things. So as I'm telling you, in 2021 now, I had to go to my mother and ask her about the details of this journey. Because I really forgot about it. I like not every detail. I just burned it in my mind. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to think about it because it was as miserable as I'm telling you.
It's post-traumatic stress disorder is where you, for want of a better, you try and compartmentalize to place it somewhere that you don't have to deal with it because it's horrific. But what happens is it comes out at some stage. It's a dreadful, dreadful thing. It's a mental health issue. It's appalling.
Absolutely, man. Anyway, well, I just want to tell the death story journey to the end, and I just want to complete it to the end. We were just, like, really scared. The smuggler told us, hey, guys, if the truck driver doesn't come, and, like, either you walk away and try you to survive yourself, or if you stay here, I will try to protect you with my rifle. But I don't think I can, like, do against 100 soldiers or something. Because when they arrive to you, you have to choose how to get murdered. With a knife or get shot. Look, this said exactly like that. At this moment, my father jumped like out of the middle of the nowhere and just begged him, go to this truck driver and bring him or just shoot him. So the smuggler was like, okay, good idea. I'm doing that, man. And he went and we were just praying to God that this smuggler, this very one good smuggler, I think, just doesn't flee alone. And somehow, a miracle happens. In the morning, we heard a truck coming. We heard a truck coming, and somehow the truck driver agreed to come. And we went inside the truck, and we drove like 1 kilometer. And so we reached the Jordanian borders, and we were lucky to be processed immediately. It was like a miracle.
Where did they put you, in Zatari or Azraq?
The day after, we were taken to our first home in Jordan. It was the Azraq camp, man. Actually, my mother just dropped down and she was just crying, man. When she saw all the huts, what is this? She was like, what is this?
But I mean, you lived a very comfortable life, didn't you? You had friends coming around and your swimming pool and all that sort of stuff, to have everything taken off you.
In Syria.
Including the possibility of a future.
Yeah.
Yeah, in Syria. Yeah.
Exactly, man. So one thing I want to address about the Azraq camp, I want to talk about somebody. I think you know him. It's Mit'ib. It's my English teacher. So he worked at the Relief International in the Azraq camp. And, well, somehow by a miracle, because Syrians, I don't know if you know about that, they don't just speak English. They are really bad English speakers. And somehow I met my teacher, Mit'ib, and he's a very well educated teacher. He was a translator in Syria. And man, what a teacher, man. So this teacher, he watched out for me step by step. We talked every day in English.
He was a gift from God, Hassan, was he?
Absolutely, man. He taught and supported and guided me like really carefully until I became a perfection piece for him. Until I became the man you are interviewing today. So,
okay, and where is he now?
He preferred to staying in the camp.
He's still in the camp. He's still in Azraq.
Yeah, man. And has been for 7 years there, giving so much of his time and effort, support high school students and trying just to make the world a better place, man. Although he can get a scholarship and go to Europe, but he just preferred to stay there and just build generation, which I really, really, really want to express my gratitude for him.
Hossam, you had already got some family already in Stuttgart at that stage. But when I met you, it was very difficult for you because you had left the camp without permission. You also had a problem with your passport was going to be up in January. You were on a very short window on your passport. And once your passport was out of date, it was going to be impossible for you to travel. I know you, and of course, the Syrian embassy in Amman, you were going to run out and you couldn't replace papers because of the war. So you needed to get out really quickly. Or if you were caught by the Jordanian authorities, you and your mother would have been put back in Azraq.
Absolutely. If you remember that back in the days, I told the guys, I told Neem, and I told the World Vision guys, don't bring police with you.
Yeah, I know.
Because I was scared of police. If they get us, we would just get deported back to the camp. And if we go back to the camp, we will never, ever again get permit to go outside of the camp.
Yeah, I remember you told me your papers came through because it was very difficult for us to help. And I remember you contacted me and you said you're on your way and there was a stop off. Tell us about the plane journey because you'd never been on an aeroplane before, had you?
Yeah, absolutely. So we somehow booked the cheapest plane on earth. I don't know what airlines it was, but I think it was the Greece one. We stopped in Greece like two times because an emergency thing happened in Greece and we had to change the airplane. So anyway, it was much better than the Jordanian-Syrian trip, the death wave journey. After that, man, I can remember this moment. I took two selfies walking out of the airplane in Germany. This was the first time stepping in Germany.
I think you sent a photograph to me when you were on the plane. I couldn't believe it. I was really happy for you, man. I was so happy for you. It was brilliant.
Lovely, man. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it happened. It was a dream coming true. Yeah. And look at me, man.
That was Hossam al-Haraki, who fled Syria at the age of 16 and now lives in Germany. This is our last episode of Syria's Lost Generation. I hope we managed to convey something new and interesting about the war and about the plight of young people who find themselves displaced across the region. The show is a production of Foreign Policy in partnership with World Vision International and the Syrian American Medical Society. Both are non-political groups, purely focused on the humanitarian aspects of the crisis. Our producers are Rob Sachs, Alison Meekham, and Dan Efron. David Enders reported the stories you're hearing on the show. Thanks to Laura Gemmel, Josephine El-Haddad, Elias Abuata, John Doutzenberg, Lobna Hassari, and Angie Maraud for helping bring the series to life. Also thanks to Final Step Studio in Beirut for production help. And thanks to you, our listeners. I'm Liam Cunningham.